Hi there, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot Whistleblower Radio, and very happy to be here tonight. It's been a very interesting day. Sorry if I'm sort of having a bit of a laugh here. We've had some interesting conversations going on this today, and I guess, you know, energetically there's a lot going on, as people may appreciate, in their own sort of universes, whatever you want to call that. I'm very, very happy to have this guest here with me this evening. I'm going to probably mispronounce his name, but it's I believe it's Ole Damgaard, and I'm going to double check with that. And I just want to say he's the author of Coup d'Etat in Slow Motion, and all of that information is on the front page of Project Camelot. If you go down to the radio icon and click on his bio, it will take you to his website, which is a very nicely designed website. I believe he did it himself. He's also an artist and a musician. And I think he's involved in yoga. He's been an investigative journalist, and I guess he can tell you a lot more about himself. This is a fascinating book, and he was initially, interviewed on Red Ice Radio, which is that interview. The first one was sent over to me by somebody, a Camelot fan, and piqued my interest right away. And then I took a look at the book and was fascinated immediately. So I just had to have him on the show. So I'm very excited to have you here, Ole. Am I saying your name correct?
It sounds beautiful. Thank you.
Okay. I'm glad to hear that. So, and I also realized, because I read this small magazine article about you that you directed me to, which means that you're actually born in Denmark, correct?
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. And because I was thinking you were Swedish, are you Swedish at all, or just not, or do you just were living there for a long time?
No, I moved to Sweden when I was 8 years old with my family.
Okay. And you do have a beautiful family now as well. So, and people again who can go to the website will see all of that. We have a chat room, by the way, associated with this radio show. And so people that are interested can go to the front page of Camelot, which is projectcamelot.org or projectcamelotportal.com or projectcamelot.tv. All of them go to the same place. And scroll down to where you see Whistleblower Radio. The live chat is what you click on if you want to join the chat, and I encourage you to do so. All you have to do is put in any name you like. You can use your own or another one, whatever you feel comfortable with today, and then hit log in. You don't have to even put in a password or join or any of the rest of that stuff, and you'll be on the chat. So this is a place where you can chat. Ask questions, put the questions in all caps, and when I get a chance, I will look at the chat and try to ask some of the questions as we go along here. And let me see what other order of business do I have. Just to give everyone a heads up, I am doing a conference, an Awaken Aware 2013 conference on the 5th, 6th, and 7th of April. We are selling tickets. They've started to sell now. And if you go to the front page of Camelot, you'll see that the second banner on the top, we have scrolling banners that go by, is announcing the conference. It is on time travel and other worlds. And I encourage everyone to come down and join us at Joshua Tree. It's going to be a lot of fun. You can even camp probably in April. It'll probably be quite warm. It's in the desert near Palm Springs. And you can camp for quite cheap there, and it's absolutely gorgeous. I've camped before in my time. So if you want to stay cheaply, that's a great way to do it as well. Okay, so Ole, we are going to go down this road. I'm very happy that you've done this research, and I know you spent like 12 years of your life doing this. And I admire that very much. I even spoke to your brother, who apparently is an avid investigator to some degree as well. All credits you with all of the work. but I think he named the book. Is that correct?
He did what?
He says that he came up with the name of the book, Coup d'Etat in Slow Motion. Maybe he didn't.
That might be so.
Okay. whatever. So anyway, why don't you say a little bit about yourself, about your background, and how you got so wrapped up in this amazing conspiracy, and then how it we can kind of get into the details and how it branched out from there.
Okay, I think it all began when I grew up. Like I said, I was born in Denmark, and my dad and my whole family was very much involved in the resistance movement against the German invasion. And so I grew up together with my brother and sister. We grew up hearing all these stories about how they fought the German armies and how you had to stand up for what is right. And I had on my grandmother's side, they were sort of smuggling arms in what do you call it, baby carriages. No, I don't know what you call those. Do you know the ones where you walk around with a baby in front of you?
Yes.
And my father was involved in this resistance movement and so on. And then we moved to Sweden and I grew up, and I thought I grew up in the perfect world. You know, we were always being told in Sweden that this is the most wonderful country in the world. It's free. It's a democracy. You know, we help the poor, the weak, and so. It was, I grew up in a beautiful country, I thought. And then I think it was about, well, I remember when Kennedy was assassinated, and I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis when my parents got really freaked out because of the threat of the nuclear war and so on. So that made a really emotional impact on me, even though I was really only a very tiny little child. And I think it was in the, maybe it was early 1980s or something like that, the first time I saw the Zapruder film. And that was the time when I noticed that, my God, something is really wrong here, because that was the first time I saw the impact of the and the angles that was totally not compatible with the official version and so on. So I got very, very interested in the JFK assassination. And I think I ended up with reading maybe a couple of hundred books about it, because it was, the more I got into it, the more complicated I found it. And I just got totally fascinated. And also I got so intrigued by that people kept popping up in different positions and different roles in the assassination. Like, the same person could be working for the CIA, and then suddenly in another book he was part of the mafia, and in another book he was working for the FBI, and in another book he was an informer. And so it got very confusing for me. So I started, for my own sake, I put together a book trying to explain it to myself. And then while I was doing that, I got more and more interested in the Robert Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, I mean, almost all the way back to Julius Caesar. And after a while, it was like I started getting a very clear picture. Like, it was almost like there was a template for how a political assassination was done. And even though the details could differ, the big picture would be more or less the same. So even though the person could be assassinated in different ways, the way they covered it up followed a very strict, like almost like a bullet list. Like, so I got very intrigued in this, and I thought, my God, could it be that it's actually true that they are following like a bullet list? And if so, could it be the same type of people behind it? And at that time, this was mid-80s, and so I was deeply buried in the JFK assassination, trying to figure that one out. And then in 1986, in February, the Swedish Prime Minister Olof Palme was shot down in the streets of Stockholm. And I, like everybody else who lived in Sweden, thought that we live in a perfect country with a police that you can trust, and We were told there was a lone crazy guy who shot him down randomly, and I thought for sure, no problem. They're gonna find him and sentence him the way it should be done. But then time went on and on and on, and nothing happened. They were looking at different suspects and stuff. But then I started seeing the same type of template being followed, which really, really confused me, because I thought, oh my God, what is going on here? And it came to a point where when I looked at the other assassinations and followed the sort of the bullet list for those assassinations, I started seeing that if what I believe is true, then the next thing that will happen from the official investigation will be that they blah, 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 blah. And so I checked that out, and within the next few weeks, they did exactly that. They went out in the press and did exactly whatever, blah, I can't remember what it was, but it was exactly the thing that followed this bullet list. And that really freaked me out, because I thought, oh my God, it's happening again and right in front of our eyes. So at that time, my brother and I had gone up straight after the shooting. We went up the following morning, and he went around, took photos and everything. So I was at the site within a few hours afterwards, and I got the whole, I mean, it's been such a traumatic experience for Sweden, because before the assassination, Sweden was a very, very peaceful country, at least official. There was hardly any crimes, no violence, no nothing. And Sweden was very proud of being, I think, one of the few countries in the world where the prime minister could take his bicycle to work, and so were no bodyguards and all of this. And that really stopped that night. When these shots were fired, the whole country started changing character to what it is today, which is a much more hard, violent, well, it's just like many other countries in the world.
Absolutely. Well, I'm wondering, you know, I understand how you came to sort of investigate this, but you stayed at it for so long. And if you had first researched the Kennedy assassination, was it before the assassination of your president that you were already interested in assassinations per se?
Yeah, that was several years before.
Okay.
Otherwise, I wouldn't have noticed. I would have still thought that everything was okay, you know, with the Swedish way of doing it. But what I found out very early, because of my research from earlier, was that this investigation is not a real investigation. This is a cover-up, you know. So that really started, yes, made me interested in finding out what is going on. So what I did was I quit my job and I moved to Stockholm, and I started working as a bus driver and different kinds of just jobs to keep me alive, for the sole purpose of being there right in the center of where it all happened. And had I known what I started, the trip I started, I'm not sure I would have gone all the way, because I had no idea of how massive this conspiracy is and the connections everywhere and the danger involved as well, because it has turned out to be a very dangerous area to go into, which I think many of your guests who have been in similar situations know about, many of which are not with us anymore. And
well, yes, that's right. And Camelot is familiar with this sort of danger. But I do want to go into all of that. What I'm wondering, though, is was your understanding of the political situation in Sweden at the time such that you had, or no one had, any suspicions that the prime minister might have been getting into deep water by some of his political decisions? did it kind of occur to you? Did you have any thoughts along those lines, or did anyone ever talk about that, you know, where he might be doing things against the grain, so to speak?
I'm sorry, it broke up, the last part of it. Could you please say again?
Yeah. Did you have any thought about your prime minister before he was killed, his political decisions impacting what might happen? In other words, did you have any what I might call precog cognition about it? Did you have, did anyone around you, did newspapers talk about how sort of unusual he was as a ruler, or was everything just taken as a matter of course?
The thing was, I've never been interested in politics, so I wasn't interested in him either. He was not a very pleasant man, in my opinion. And he was a politician he was not an ordinary guy. He created very strong feelings. Either people loved him or they really, really hated him. So also, he was one of the few Swedish politicians that was very big on an international level as well. And so I had no idea about the things behind this, not at all. I know that in the papers it was mentioned in the beginning, but nothing to the extent that I know now was behind it.
Okay. I have to say, though, you stuck with this, because this is an amazing book. Let me just tell people who haven't already downloaded it, and please do make a contribution, because, you know, I actually feel bad that you're not charging money for your book, because you've done so much work, and it's really a good read, actually. I'm finding it fascinating, and I really think it'd make an amazing movie. So I'm going to see what I can do over here to see if anything can happen in that regard. But I'm actually kind of surprised if Hollywood hasn't already taken you up on it. And maybe this interview itself will stimulate that kind of interest. But because of the, you know, in a sense, we're talking about Sweden as a microcosm of a macrocosm, which is the rest of the world. And so what happens with this assassination, the way you looked at it and the way you were able to extrapolate, because you've done the investigations of the Kennedy assassination, and how you realized that people could play different roles and be seen differently, and how, you know, the incredible delays at that time, I mean, that just seem too convenient, things not working, just ridiculous things. And then people's reactions, the strange reactions, people's reactions being very, very strange. Even the wife's reaction, certainly the son. I'm not far enough along, because I don't know the final answer. So I don't know who you think did it. I do know that they set up a patsy. I get that much. I did go further and flip sort of far into the future of the book, because I had to do this interview with you today and I wasn't reading fast enough, and to get to, you know, see if there was anything that developed in the future. And we can kind of talk about that. But I did see that there was a very interesting, I think it was a movie or a film. And I don't know if it was in Mexico or South America or something. And you talk about it as an analogy for what actually may have happened. Can I
take you back, since I know maybe many of your listeners are not aware of what happened that evening. Maybe I can take you back to what happened.
Okay.
The thing was that about 6 months before his assassination, Olof Palme started to act really strange. He started doing very, very odd things that confused many people around him, and also made many, many, many people pissed off, to say the least. The thing is with Olof Palme that he, just like Kennedy, the minister's shots were fired. He was given an almost angelic aura. You know, he turned into a saint overnight. which is not the person he was when you check, when you start looking into his background. He's got a very, very strange background when you look into it. I'm not talking about the official version. I'm talking about when you go underneath it. And Olof Palme, I'll give you the official version. The official version is that he was a politician, a social democrat, a man of the people, a man who defended human rights, who opened up the borders for illegal aliens to, or not illegal, but aliens to come into and get asylum in Sweden. He was going all over the world, being the first one to be welcomed in Cuba by PLO, the Nicaragua, and so on, the Sandinists there. And but when you look at his actions behind the scenes, you see a different pattern. You do not see that he's walking his talk. It's very similar to Obama, if I can say that. He's very nice to look at. He says beautiful things. You really want to believe him, but his actions are totally working the other way. And that was the same with Olof Palme. And when you look into it, he was a member of the Bilderberg Group. Are you aware of these the Bilderberg Group, the global elite?
Yes, of course. Yes.
Of course. Yep. I'm sorry. Stupid question.
That's okay. But, no problem. You know, you haven't had a lot of time between when I asked you to come on board and listen to the Camelot videos and so on. But no problem. Yes.
Yeah. Of course. I just wanted to. So he was a member of the Bilderberg Group, who is an elite group working for a very centralized global. One state, one global fascist state with a one currency, a very controlled population, and so on. And just being a very active member there shows that what he was talking about in his speeches and so on, it doesn't make any sense. They're pointing totally two different directions. He was also a member of the Committee of 300, who are working to centralize the whole monetary system, to get everything into one world bank for total control as well, which also shows that he was not only what he was appearing to be. And when you look back through his youth and where he came from a bourgeois, quite right-wing family, a family with quite odd connections, like his uncle on his mother's side was deeply involved with E.G. Farben, who was in many ways the financier of the German war machine. This uncle was also sentenced in Nuremberg for crimes against humanity. He was there were quite a few links to real Nazi organizations. Also, he was involved when he started his career. He was involved with military intelligence, and because of this, he was part of building up the Stay Behind movement in Sweden together with William Colby, who later became the boss of the CIA in the States. Sweden does not belong to NATO and didn't in those days either. So it was a neutral country official. So it's totally against the what normal people knew. They were working undercover, more or less, to build up this Stay Behind Gladio network. It's like a ghost army NATO and CIA started and created in the beginning of the 1950s. William Colby came to Sweden and stayed in Stockholm for a few years while he was building it up there. And this Stay Behind Net was created, so the official version was that it was created so that if a NATO country would be invaded from the east, let's say, then there would already be like a guerrilla type of army ready that could be activated within hours to start defending the country. And this network was built up by small groups of 8 to 10 people, with weapon depot, fuel depots, communication equipment, arms, and all of these things.
Hi there, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot Whistleblower Radio on Revolution Radio, and we have a very interesting guest, Ola Damagard. Ola, so you were just talking about this sort of advance guard, in a sense, that was being sort of financed, I guess, and organized on to work to protect Sweden in case of an invasion from the east, you said.
Yeah, but this was not only Sweden. Officially, like I said, Sweden is a neutral country, or was, and not part of NATO. But this Stay Behind movement, or Gladio, it comes under many, many different names, was built up in all the different NATO countries. So it was a very big network. And the problem with this network was that there were an extreme amount of right-wing elements, very right-wing military men, security men, policemen, and stuff like that. And after a while as well, the CIA started using Gladio and Stay Behind as a weapon of terror. They had a strategy they called the strategy of tension, where they inflicted so-called terror attacks on normal people all over the place to scare society so that people in different countries would be more and more willing to accept more and more control and so-called protection. So this Stay Behind movement has been behind so many of the terror attacks we've seen in the Western world. And also it is very central in this assassination of Olof Palme as well. We're going to see that soon.
Okay, so can you now go to talk about exactly what went on that night without going into too much detail so that we can move on from there? Because I know some people will be able to listen to the Red Ice Radio, and I want to try to build on what you've said there as well.
Okay, so that evening, like I said, the about 6 months before his assassination, he started acting very odd. And also the last, I think it was about 6 weeks before he was shot, there was starting to pop up observations of people with walkie-talkie around his home, in the streets around where he was working, and so on. Also, some people were approached by people from the CIA. I'm going to go into the identity to Z later on. They were being asked if they would want to be part of an assassination of Olof Palme. There were also meetings around Sweden, secret meetings with right-wing elements, right-wing policemen, and so on. Also, where they really were starting to see him as a massive traitor. He was just in the process of arranging a meeting in just a month later, going to Moscow to meet Gorbachev, and people were very afraid that he was going to sell out Sweden. He also started doing, he wanted Sweden and Scandinavia as a nuclear-free zone, which was a big threat to the Navy, submarines, and also because Sweden is such an important country because of its strategic position for the world. So he also started stopping different arms deals that he was involved in, transports that there was a massive scandal some years later called the Bofors scandal, where Sweden had been part of a big international secret network of sending weapons to countries like Iran and other war-fighting countries, which was totally illegal, and that where he was deeply involved in that. But on that evening, what happened was that he and his wife had decided to go to the cinema together with his son and the son's girlfriend. So they decided About the early afternoon, they decided to go to the cinema. And on that day, Olof Palme had said to his bodyguards that, "I don't need you anymore. Today, you just take the rest of the day off." And so in the evening, they took, they were living in the old town of Stockholm, and they took the subway into the cinema. Some people observed that there were two people following them. And they went to the cinema, and then the cinema was for about an hour and a half. After that, about 11 o'clock at night, they decided to walk home instead of taking the subway. So they were walking south down one of the main streets called Sveavägen. And it was a quite cold night, February night. It was February the 28th. And it was about 6 below 0, dark. There was very few people in the city because it was the sport holiday in Sweden. So most of Stockholm were on ski holiday, including the parliament and the king and everybody. So Stockholm was quite deserted at that time. They walked down the street, they crossed it, and the official story says that the shooter was standing waiting for them at a corner of a big building called the Skandia building. And when they walked past the killer, he walked out behind them, put his hand on his left shoulder, and just fired one shot that went right through his body and killed him instantly. So he just went straight into the pavement. When he fell, he dragged his wife with him a bit. And the shooter then aimed at her, fired a second shot, and then, but missed her, and then took off, ran into an alleyway, up some stairs, and that was the last time he was observed by anyone. That's the official version. From then on, no one has really figured out who he is, who he was, who shot him. And the official story is that it was a lone crazy guy. They later got hold of a patsy called Christer Pettersson, who is he's like the Swedish Lee Harvey Oswald. He was an alcoholic, a bit of a violent type, that was sentenced for the crime, later released, and later died in a very strange accident after being picked up by the police. And officially, the case is more or less closed because whatever you say, they always point back to this Christer Pettersson and say, well, there's no real point of us continuing to look into this case because we already got the guy. He was sentenced, and then due to technical problems, he was released, but we got the right guy. I'm here to say that I've written a book. It's more than 880 pages, and it, like I say, it's not because I like writing, but it's just trying to show that something else happened, you know? So it's a good idea to take the two versions and balance them to each other. Lone crazy guy, no motive, no reason, no, you know, no guns, no nothing. And then you have this incredible conspiracy that I'm trying to present in an understandable way, with connections all over the place into everything from, well, I've even got very strong connections to the JFK assassination, which I hope we can go into later on. But Iran-Contras, arms deals, pedophile gangs, you got, well, all of it. It's drugs, all of it is there.
Okay, so at this moment, because I'm going to again think that some people are obviously going to read your book. I've already gotten feedback from people that are reading it and they're enjoying it. But have you, I mean, how many years did you complete the book ago, you know?
I completed it. I left Sweden in 2000 after two of my friends died under very strange circumstances. And I just felt, oof, this is getting too close. So I emigrated. I left Sweden with my family. We went to Spain, which is where I'm living now. And there I finished the book in 2001 or so. And since then, more or less nothing has happened, so it's still up to date, more or less.
Okay, and so at that point, you've sort of been away from the book in a way, I would imagine, doing other things, right? I know you've written another book. You've got all sorts of other things seeming to go on, but it's very interesting that there seems to be a resurgence of interest in this book. Did you try to generate that, or did this happen by itself?
The interest in the book, you mean?
Yes.
No, there's been very early on, I noticed that there's two ways to do this. Because I saw, when I started looking into this assassination, I saw there was a lot of strange suicides and accidents and people getting totally mangled in the system or discredited or beaten up or whatever. So I felt that if I want to make a difference here, there are two ways to go. Either get into the spotlight big time or keep a very low profile. And as a protection, I'm talking about. And I'm a Mr. Nobody type of thing, so I would be very vulnerable and very open and easy to become one of the statistics. So I decided to keep a very, very low profile during all of these years. So very few people have heard of me, I think, I hope. And that's also why I've been able to write this book. Then once I got it finished, by then I also knew the network and how extensive these networks are and interconnected with Freemasonry and how difficult it is to know who you can trust. Because this book is not just my theory, it's been labeled like a bomb of truth, and it's with pictures, names, maps, documents, everything pointing it out, laying it out right in front of you. So I approached some publishers, but I noticed right away that they looked very scared when I approached them, or they I was looked upon being crazy, totally paranoid, conspiracy madman, that okay. type of person. And I think it was Michael Moore's Swedish agent, he had the book as well, and he said, if you publish this, you're going to be sued from here to the moon. And since I'm not strong financially, I thought, there's no way I can do this on my own. So I decided to keep a low profile until the time was right. Then in 2000, and I put the book on the shelf, just getting on with my life and doing other things that I found important, and just waiting, having that on standby. Then I went out 2009 on a radio show here in Spain, where we really tried to pinpoint the elite. We tried to expose about chemtrails and the vaccine, all of these things, to try and stop some madness. And it went out into 60 countries there, thanks to my brother, among others. And the reactions was very, very powerful, I must say. Then I was warned, so I took a step back. Because when you're up against these powers, I mean, they're very powerful, these people. And they solve their problems in a violent way. So if you want to stay in the living part of humanity, it's like you need to do it with some kind of feeling. So I've been pushing, and then as soon as I felt that I've stepped too far, I took a step back, I waited, and then I took a step forward, pushed, and then when I met resistance, I took a step back, and that's the way I've been doing it.
So okay.
Then in December this year, or 2012, a friend of mine said that a Swedish author had put up her book on the internet for free, just because she had problems with a publisher, and then just with a donation button. And I thought, that's a really good idea. So what I did was I put it up there for free. I spread it out there within hours, getting it all over the place so that the pressure went away from my shoulders, so that the information was out there. And after that, it's just taking off. It's like a tidal wave of interest.
Good. It is fascinating. And again, because you're pulling all these disparate elements together in one place, and I think people from around the world can identify, because they will also have their microcosm, their assassination, their incidents that go on in their countries, and to be able to see how these games are being played by the powers that be is quite a fascinating exercise, and I think very educational. For those of us that wish to change the system, it's very important to be aware of what's going on here. So with that, you have followed the trail all the way through. And I also noticed, because I'm reading the very end, you've got some sort of appendixes, I'm not sure what you call them, written by some other people that are sort of related documents, right? Articles like the one on Pegasus that give kind of a background, would you say?
It gives a background, but it also gives an insight into that type of world. You know, because what I describe may sound really way out there, just too much, but when you see how these people act and what they do, they're very active. And like you say, so many of these strange deaths and accidents and conspiracies, they're connected. So many, if not all of them, are connected in one way or another. It's a big, big network. So many of these, like you said as well, in different countries and different, the more you look into it, the more I've looked into it, it doesn't matter if I looked at 9/11, Oklahoma City, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, JFK, Olof Palme, many different assassinations in Europe and so on. They're all connected. It's the same power elite behind them. And very often they're also using the same hit squad that are just in different constellations. They use them in different parts. So people who are being assassinated in South Africa, in Chile, in Sweden, in the States, are often being killed by the same people.
Absolutely.
With local backups.
And the leaders are also, they also have these checkered paths that, you know, in a sense that Palma did, right? In other words, he, as you said, he wasn't a black and white character. He had many sort of aspects to his personality, and on the one hand he appeared to be doing some good things. On the other hand, if you follow the trail, you can see that his family lineage was very much involved in with these people. So this is the trail that, just so you know, Project Camelot has been following for a very long time as well, and this is again why we're very interested in your book. What I wanted to know was, if you've been putting the pieces together, and I haven't finished the book, but I'm asking, have you decided on your own theory of what exactly happened? In other words, because you what I'm noticing is you tend to describe all the different possibilities, but then do you narrow it down and make a choice, or do you keep it open?
Yeah. Yes, very much so.
Okay. Do you want to talk about the trail? If you were to go from beginning to end of the story, you know, with the time that we have to ask other questions as well, but if you could describe what you think really happened.
Okay, there were two different operations going on at the same time. If you noticed with 9/11 and other stuff, there's very often more than one operation going on at the same time, making it very confusing for someone like myself to look into, because it's just pointing all over the place when you try to find out what happened. But if I take the general operation of what happened, was that he was there was a hit ordered on him. The order went to it came from very high up in hierarchy, but it was sent down, if we go down to the street level, to who actually did it. The order was sent to a colonel in South Africa. His name is Craig Williamson. He was he used to be he was labeled the super spy. He infiltrated through the ANC. They said that he was that he was helping the ANC in South Africa, and that he was being tortured and stuff like that. So he came to Sweden as getting asylum, more or less. And then he worked his way up through the political corridors. And in the end, he was even writing speeches to the top politicians in Sweden. I don't know if he did it for Parliament, but he did it to people very close to him. Meaning also that he knew Stockholm very, very well. And the political system, he knew the he knew everything around these top politicians. Then this was years earlier, and he was when they found out who he was, he escaped back to South Africa, and there he was made a major and celebrated as a hero. Anyway, the order to commit this assassination was sent to him, so he put together a hit team. And he used some of his local people, one Rhodesian mercenary called Anthony White. There was another one, a South African person. These people are very, very violent, extremely violent and highly disciplined, most of them. Another one was Rian Stander, who was, I think, one of the walkie-talkie men that was observed in Stockholm. You have another one, Peter Castleton, who was also one of the surveillance team, who was later crushed by a truck. These were the South African ones. They went on an airplane from South Africa to Luxembourg, where they were picked up by another BOS agent. BOS is the secret police of South Africa. It's a West German guy called Franz Esser. He picked them up. He and his family was later killed in an accident as well, a car accident, a very strange one. They picked him up. He picked up these three guys, and they went in a camper van through Denmark, Germany, Denmark, and into Sweden. And then they stayed there for about 5-6 weeks, keeping Olof Palme under surveillance. And there's about between 50 and 150 observations of people with walkie-talkies around Palmer's home, around the parliament, around the where he was hit later on. All of these witnesses have been neglected by the official investigation. None of them have been taken seriously. Anyway, so we have this team who are there. If I can just say how these operations are normally done. You got the hit team itself, which are highly skilled mercenaries.
Hi there, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot, Whistleblower Radio, and we are talking to Ole Damgaard. Ole, are you there?
I am indeed.
Okay, very good. So you were just starting to describe the trajectory of who did, in your opinion, after all these years of research, the conclusion that you've reached on who actually carried this out and then how it was carried out. And we were to the point where we were, this group of men were in the country, and you said that you believe there's actually two different teams at work. So please do continue.
Yeah, to do an operation like this, you need quite a lot of people. And normally it's done like, first you have one group that go in, they call it the surveillance group, that they check out the victim to be. They find out everything about him, where is the best way to hit and so on. Then you got the hit team itself, like I said, very highly skilled mercenaries brought in from different countries, different groups with no apparent connecting points. Then you have a patsy that you prepare, where this is often a guy that looks good in the media. He looks violent and strange, and then you have prepared evidence against him, and then you have your own investigation on standby with your own people that will just take over and push out all normal, ordinary, honest policemen and stuff like that. They will just be pushed aside, and your own investigation will be moving forward. And their only task is to point everywhere else than the truth. It's like the Warren Commission. They will just be pointing. They went that way. They went that way. They went that way. Anything but towards the real truth. And also, you have a cleanup team right after the shooting. They go in at the site of where it happened and clean up any kind of evidence that could mess it up. You also have backup teams that help the hit team to get away. And one of the main, or the first way you can see that there is actually a conspiracy going on is what is not happening. Like I said, if I was down in central Stockholm today and I pulled out a gun and just fired a shot up in the air, within 2 minutes I would be totally bombarded with the policemen. There would be, the streets would be blocked off. I would have, there would be SWAT teams, and it would just be a massive thing happening around, a massive police organization that would get going. But with the Olof Palme assassination, absolutely nothing happened. And we got like,
yeah, it's absolutely stunning. The studied ineptitude that you describe in the book, and for that alone, it's kind of a fascinating study, because there's no way that there could be such delays in so many different places without some negligence, purposeful negligence, yeah. Without somebody having been given the order behind the scenes to stand down, to not yeah. acknowledge certain things. And the other thing is also the technical dropout. This was also fascinating.
Yeah, if we go back to the hit team, if I can do that, we have the South African part of it. Then they had Craig Williamson had called in a very, very skilled mass murderer assassin called Michael Vernon Townley. He was working for the CAN and DINA in Chile, and involved in many, many different assassinations of the big ones. I'm going to connect many of them later on. You had another called in, it was his personal friend, Stefano Della Chiai, an Italian mass murderer as well. He was called the King of Terror, and he was educating many of the people that later committed terror acts in Europe and other places. Then you had a third one, a German called Heine Hymann, who was a sleeping agent in Sweden, and these people were meeting up with, all of them were meeting up in Stockholm at that time, together with an Argentinian hitman called Roberto Tieme, and his Spanish Basquian friend called Julio Izquierdo. All of these were most of them had been worked with under stay behind and also in connection with CIA. They go back way back, and like Townley was even involved in the JFK assassination. I'm going to go back into that later on. But then that is the group that came and was in Stockholm together with a Norwegian mercenary called Ole Christian Olstad. These were the hit team, and they used three different escape cars. There was a white Volvo, a red Ford Fiesta, and a light blue Volkswagen Passat. But to do a thing like this, you have the hit team, but you need local backup. That is standard in these operations. You need people that know the area, that have the contacts with housing, that can supply weapon, food, all of these things, whatever is needed, communication equipment and so on. And in Sweden, this was done by partly by Stay Behind, but also by a group of right extremist policemen that was located in a police station called Norrmalms police station, which is it's the most central police station in Stockholm. They are the ones who are taking care of the parliament, the royal castle, and so on. These people, it was only a group of like 10 members, and they were called the Baseball Gang. They got that name because it was a group that was organized to clear the streets, like it was said, to clean the streets of drug addicts or whatever. And they dressed in civilian clothes and baseball caps. And they were very, very extremely violent. And they even beat some people up so badly that they died. This little group of 10 people are in all the central positions this evening. Just that evening, they jump into these key positions. Like one of them, his name was Ulf Helin, he jumped into he was the one in the communication central where when witnesses called in and said, there's been a shooting here, there's been a shooting, he was the one who received the calls, delayed them, and then sent out an alert that only went to a few police vehicles, police vans, that was equipped with members from this group. They were also the first cars that came to the assassination site, except for the police chief, Gösta Söderström, who was the highest in command that evening and who had nothing to do with this whole thing. But this group of policemen, they were also the ones that was chasing the murderer, or officially chasing them. There were witnesses say they were laughing and running around, and they looked like kids in the playground. Anyway, there was another police car that was driving around with, the driver was from this baseball gang. His name was Thomas Ekesäter, and he had a police commander there. His name was Christian Dahlsgaard. That car was, according to what people observed, filled with technical equipment in the back seat. And there was also quite a few observations of people with walkie-talkies around the assassination site. These people were identified as Thomas Pilz from the baseball gang, another one Leif Tell from the baseball gang as well, and another one, his name was Antti Avsan. Today he's a moderate politician for the moderate party in Sweden. You see him on TV from time to time. He was identified as the so-called Dekorima man, the guy who was standing on the corner waiting for the prime minister and his wife to come. But as far as I've been able to find out, he was swapped just before the shooting. So the actual shooter, they swapped places. Then we have Carl Gustav Östling, who was a very strange person, a policeman, but with connections very, very high up, and it only makes logic if you connect him with Stay Behind. He was a weapons expert. He was an expert on electronics, and he was the guy who helped the Swedish police choose what arm to choose for the whole police corps. He was also involved in quite a few scandals around that he had been selling weapons to the Swedish defense material buyers with no receipts. They were buying from him in very odd ways. And he was also later involved as these members in this baseball gang were later also the bodyguards of the chief investigator. So they're on both sides being suspected and on the other side part of the investigation. And this pops up again and again that you have people on both sides, which is very strange in my way of seeing it. Then you got one of Östling, this arms dealer, one of his friends, who he was a major, Ingvar Grundborg. And at this time he had a highly security cleared position in the telecommunication system of Stockholm. So that night, he was in control of all radio traffic in Stockholm and could, he could do whatever. The day after the assassination, he stopped working there, and later the guy who took over his job was this exact called Gustav Östling, who also when a few years later when they did a raid at his home, it turned out that Östling's apartment was totally filled with guns, everything from bazookas to grenades to hand grenades to submachine guns. It was just lots and lots and lots. And one of the things they found there as well was the exact same type of bullet that Olof Palme was killed with. These bullets were very, very odd. There's so many odd things in this case. You know, officially, like, Olof Palme was shot and one bullet just went right through him. Then the second shot was fired at his wife. But they cornered off the whole assassination site right away. And they did like a 7-hour investigation, a technical thing with magnets and everything, looking for evidence. The only thing they found was half a button from his suit. No bullets, no nothing. Then 37 hours later, a bullet was found. Where was it found? Was it found like a kilometer down the road where it would have been in the direction if it fired, like it's officially said to have been fired? No, it was found 7 meters from the site where he died, behind a concrete pillar, totally pristine. Go figure.
And this can't be, this obviously can't be the actual bullet. Somebody planted it there for a reason, right?
Kerry, in my opinion, these cases, if you take JFK or whatever, they're no-brainers and at the same time super complicated. Do you know? It's like you say, it doesn't take, you don't have to be very clever to figure out that that bullet could not end up there. Then you have this the second bullet that was fired at his wife. It turned up. Where did it turn up? Once again, I mean, a bullet like that, we're talking about a 357 Magnum. It's one, at that time, it was one of the most powerful handguns in the world. That's the official story, that this is the murder weapon. Where did the bullet end up? 40 meters from the site, on the other side of the street, in a totally wrong angle, more or less pristine, on top of a little heap of snow. And who found it? It was found by an Indian freelance journalist who put himself in hypnotic trance and went around saying, where is the bullet? Where is the bullet? Oh, there it is. And he picked it up and gave it to the police. This is the official story. Okay. He was later, it turned out that he was working for different kind of secret organizations as well. But he was also a freelance for Swedish radio. And the other bullet that was found was also found by one of the employers from Swedish radio. I'm not saying, I'm not accusing anything. I'm just saying, if you look at 9/11, look at all of the witnesses that are calling in during the live broadcasting. All of the people saying, this is happening, this is happening. All of them had some kind of connection to the different networks.
Yes, very interesting. Okay, so...
So, again, there's a bit of a weird thing around there.
Yeah, I get that. The trouble is that we've only got, about a little over a half hour.
For the show.
And what I need you to do here is move along a bit further. So if you can, you know, what we're doing is we're kind of following a path with you to what you think actually did happen. And the team has been assembled. We've got people with walkie-talkies. So basically, you've got the shooter, I guess, positioned somewhere. And then can you kind of complete that quickly so that we can make, you know, jump on to some other areas?
Yeah. I'm sorry if I get too long.
That's all right.
But what happened was, as far as I know, when the team found out that the couple was going to the cinema. It was the perfect day. It was a Friday, where everybody had left the city, the government, the king, everybody was out of the way. It was also like there was very few witnesses. And so at that, in the afternoon, when they heard that he was going to the cinema, it was the perfect site as well, because it was just opposite the Social Democrat headquarters that they had already checked out. So when they went in, he was followed to the cinema. When he went in there, they were, it was super duper, because then they knew for sure that he was going to be in the same spot for 1.5 hour. So they positioned the guy just outside the cinema while all the rest of the people were getting in position. And this, I'm just, this is what witnesses have seen. So when, while they're at the cinema, you have all these strange police cars and private cars coming in and surrounding the place. Some of these police cars had never been identified because they were not on duty and so on. Then when the couple comes out and starts walking, these vehicles move on the parallel streets together with walkie-talkie men following. There's one behind them and alternative shooters down the road, walkie-talkie men on the sides. So wherever the hit would be, the shooter could run off and be covered by the other people. Anyway, when he came to where it was shot, there were on the parallel street, there were a car trying to go down the street and pass. But one of the escape cars kept turning out and blocking his way so that he couldn't pass. Then the shots were fired. The shooter ran and passed that position. After that, this car let the other one go. So you had this vehicle was positioned to stop any people from getting involved or interfering or anything like that. As far as I've been able to find out, the whole operation was controlled from a bunker underneath a fire station. It's called Johannes Brandstation, which is only 100 meters from where it was shot. And six stories down below ground level, there's a bunker there where today there's the 911 central or 112 or whatever you call it. But that was where the whole thing was organized from. Also, the site where he was shot was not just any site, because right in that building, the Scandia building, that is where the Stay Behind headquarters were located for many years. Also connected with a secret, or not, it's not secret, but there's about 618 kilometers of tunnels going underneath Stockholm on the level below the subway level. And these tunnels are connected so that you can go down there and then get all the way out of Stockholm and escape. It's meant also in case of an invasion that the parliament, king, and all of these people can have an escape route. That was partly used as well to get rid of some of the people. Then, as far as I've been able to understand, after the shooter shot Palme, he ran up the stairs. He was met by this Östling, who took the gun and ran to his apartment that was just 50 meters from there. The shooter then ran across the street and was picked up by this light blue Volkswagen that was driven by this German guy, Franz Esser. They took off, and the different escape cars, two of them met just north of Stockholm, where they swapped cars. And the shooter went into the other one, to the Volvo, and then they took off outside to a little village just north of Stockholm, where there's a little barn there owned by the Swedish government that normally is used for military equipment and so on. This barn is absolutely perfect because there's no windows, there's no neighbors looking in and so on. And there the team were met by a backup team from Stay Behind, who got the car into the barn, they swapped plates, they got rid of the equipment, they took care of the guns and so on. And then the killer was driven to, as far as I know, a small little village called Björklinge, where this other sleeping agent I mentioned earlier, Heine Hymann, had a villa. And in that villa, he was hidden until around the 3rd of March, just a few days later. After that, he was taken out on a diplomatic passport and flown to most probably Turkey. That at the same time, the other shooters, some of them went to Norway. One car went to Norway. Craig Williamson, the next morning, took the train to Gothenburg, where he flew out that way. And the whole thing with the delay was to see that the killers got away. So for about three hours, almost 3 hours, absolutely nothing happened. No one in Sweden knew what they'd even, do you know, like there was a night radio in Sweden at that time, and there was only like a few radio stations. And in the studio, they had a lamp, like an alert lamp, saying if something had happened, like the king had died or something like that, that lamp would flash, okay? That evening, like with so many of these other things, you know, just like where suddenly cameras stopped working, like when the Pentagon was hit or Lady Diana was hit, suddenly all of these cameras stopped working. Exactly the same here. This alert lamp, poof, was not working. And so it was delayed, and people abroad knew that Palme was killed before the Swedish people did.
Yes.
And like I said, the first hours, absolutely nothing happened. The people who were there were, the whole of Stockholm was totally dead. And normal police cars were driving around, not knowing that it happened either. Then 5 past 2.
And there were decisions made by the police, by the police in charge, not to get his superior away from some kind of meeting that he was in nearby town or whatever. I mean, it was just quite amazing. But at this moment, because we do have limited time, I'm sorry. I'd like to be able to have people ask you questions. We've only got 30 minutes left. We're going to have a break very shortly here, but what I would like to do is talk now a little bit on a higher level. In other words, not so much about the details, but to pull back and to look at the situation. Do you think that he had become a liability? Was it your understanding that in terms of, because we're also looking at Sandy Hook here, we're looking at a progression, what appears to be even a progression as it's continuing even to now, where you seem to be painting a picture of one sort of domino after the other to build up what may be that was, to bring Sweden on board to the New World Order in a faster way or whatever. What are your thoughts about that?
Totally. I totally agree that was the way. I must say that one thing I find is extremely important and interesting is there was a super death squad put together before the Kennedy assassination. It was called Operation 40. It was called that because it was consisted of 40 people, of exiled Cubans and other mercenaries that was highly skilled, highly brutal. And this group was put together by under supervision from Richard Nixon, financed by George Bush Sr. He was getting funds in from the oil millionaires and so on. It was actually under Eisenhower's regime. But this was put together to attack Castro to start with. But after that, they used this little tiny group of people again and again and again and again in many different areas. If I can just mention some of the names and what they were involved in, and please keep in mind that this is a very small group that is have been active more or less until today. Is it okay if I just quickly go through a few names?
Yes.
Okay, the guy that was put in charge of this group, Operation 40, as I said, his name was David Attlee Phillips. He was from military intelligence and the CIA. He was the controller.
Hi there, this is Carrie Cassidy, Project Camelot Whistleblower Radio, and we are talking to Ole Damgaard. And you were just about to talk about some people that were sort of behind the scenes in general, maybe even orchestrating other events. So you had just started with one. Can you start? Repeat that one person again, because the link up is fascinating.
Yeah, we're talking about a super death squad that was put together under the supervision of Richard Nixon, financed by George Bush Sr. Through oil money and so on. It was aimed to start towards Castro. They tried to kill him many times, but then when they couldn't trust Kennedy anymore. They just turned the cannon towards him, and they were deeply involved in the Kennedy assassination, and also in many, many others. So I'm just gonna give you some of the names. The two chiefs of the group was David Attlee Phillips, also called Howard Benson. He was the CIA controller of Lee Harvey Oswald. He was also the controller of James Files, which is one of the shooters in Dealey Plaza. He was also the controller of Michael Vernon Townley, who was almost taking part in Dealey Plaza, but afterwards in many, many assassinations that around the place. One of them being the overthrow of Allende, another Robert Smith in South Africa, and he was part of the Olof Palme assassination many years later. Okay, we got Howard Hunt. I'm sure you know Howard Hunt, who was also Dealey Plaza there. You got David Sanchez Morales. He was both in Dealey Plaza. He was also at Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy was shot. Surprise, surprise. You got Luis Posada, who's to this day is still being accused of loads and loads of terror attacks. You got Orlando Bosch, who is supplying bombs for hundreds of different bomb alerts, some of them being private airliners and so on. And then after he was sentenced for many, many of these, he was pardoned by, guess who? George Bush Sr. Thank you very much. Another guy is Felix Rodriguez. Felix Rodriguez was part of this death squad doing many awful things. He was also one of the people who tracked down Che Guevara and had him murdered. He was actually murdered by David Sanchez Morales, as far as I know. But Felix Rodriguez, many years after, he was walking around with Che Guevara's wristwatch. As a little medal or whatever. Then you had the Novo brothers, Guillermo and Ignacio, who were both involved in the Kennedy assassination. You got Pedro Luis Diaz Lanz, the Kennedy assassination. Then you got Eugenio Rolando Martinez, who was one of the Watergate burglars. You got Frank Sturgis, also called, his real name was Frank Fiorini. He was one of the shooters as well. He was the guy who's standing next to the white Chevy on the grassy knoll to the right of the trees. Then you have, we got Frank Sturgis. He was also one of the Watergate burglars. Then you got Porter Gost, who was later appointed the chief of CIA by Boy George Bush. Can you believe it? He was also one of the co-sponsors for the Patriot Act and Homeland Security. These guys are still active, you know. You got Barry.
You're saying Porter Gost, what was his role in any of these assassinations? Were you saying?
I haven't found any of the big ones, but I know that he was part of this Operation 40, and he's been very reluctant to say what he was doing over these years. I know he was, as far as I know, he was in Haiti and many other countries, but what his actual role was, I have no idea. But if you see these people, if you get to the level of chief of CIA, he has done a lot of things, I'm sure. Then you got Barry Seal, who was a pilot. He was very deeply involved in the Iran-Contras affair. He was one of the pilots flying drugs from South America to MENA in Arkansas, where the whole exchange of guns going one way, drugs going the other way. And the people meeting up in MENA, Arkansas, was the governor then, Bill Clinton, and his friend Dan Lasseter, together with George Bush Sr. That they were the ones who started the whole crack epidemic, you know, that the whole thing that started to deteriorate society in the States. Also, we have, did I say Bernard Baker, Watergate in burglar?
Not yet.
Okay, then you have Herminio Diaz Garcia. Herminio Diaz Garcia was an exiled Cuban. He was the one of the shooters on the sixth floor in the school book depository. You had, I can just go quickly through the shooters. In the Daltex building, it was Chucky Nicoletti from the Chicago mob with his radio operator was, I think his name was Hale Braden, also mob connected. Then on the sixth floor, you had Herminio Diaz Garcia, Operation 40, together with Eladio Del Valle, Operation 40, together with Richard Kane from the Chicago mob. Then if you go down further left, you have Frank Sturgis by the white Chevy. And then the guy in the police uniform, his name was Lucien Sarti. He was a hitman from the Corsican mob from Marseille. They took him over from there. And then you have the guy behind the tree who fired one of the final shots. His name is James Files. He's still around. And then you have in the manhole on the pavement, there was a shooter there as well. And as far as I know, his name was Roscoe White. He was a Dallas policeman, and he was also involved in the Tippit shooting, the officer Tippit shooting. But the actual guy that killed him was James Files' friend, Gary Marlowe. But he was also under David Attlee Phillips' control, but they didn't know about each other. He was put there.
He was put there. Actually, we're running out of time here, and this is great. This list is amazing, and I think everyone would like to do further investigation along these same lines. I think it would be great to continue this investigation that you're painting a labyrinth of connections, and I think someone who is astute enough could actually do one of these alliance charts in which you start off with one person and you draw the connections like six degrees separation, and you basically connect them around the world. And
can I mention one more?
Yes.
Just one more.
Yes.
Okay. His name was Jose Perdomo, and he was the chief of Operation 40 for about 10 years. Guess where he was working the night John Lennon was shot? He was the doorman to the left of John Lennon. When Yoko Ono and John Lennon came to the building,
wow.
You had Mark Chapman to the right, and the doorman, who by then was a nice-looking gentleman, his name was Jose Perdomo. Okay, John Lennon was shot four times from the left. Mark Chapman was standing at the right. And if you hear the first witnesses, they filled him, and they say he was arguing with a doorman. Then it's up to you to make your own conclusion. But in my opinion, very suspicious that this guy was there that night. And also Mark Chapman was friends of the Bush family. So,
right. Yes, that's been brought out. All right. Well, thank you. And you know, there's more here as well. But what I want to do is, do we have any callers, first of all, just in case?
No, ma'am.
Okay, so we've got no callers. What I wanted to do was have you sort of wrap this up, because I don't want you to be interrupted when we go off the air in about 15 minutes. And if you can sort of sum all of this up so that you can give an overview of where you think this is all going, how you want to approach this in the future. And I know you wrote another book. You can also talk about that and give your website and so on. But if you could sort of wrap everything up in sort of a summation.
Okay, first of all, my website is murderofpalme, that's palme.com, murderofpalme.com. It goes to my website. And there you can download this book, Coup d'etat in slow motion. You can download it for free, both in Swedish and English. Or if you would like to donate, I'm so, so grateful for donation. So anyway, that will help you get a more detailed picture, clearer overview. Regarding the future, I feel extremely positive because I think there's an immense awakening going on. And also the way that people are welcoming this type of information is it's almost overwhelming for me, because I've been used to being looked upon as being a very odd, crazy conspiracy nerd. So I also think that the whole elite thing, it's falling down around them. People are becoming aware, and they can't, that's why they're speeding it up. They're trying to get us in the cage as soon as possible. I heard now they're pushing forward here with the microchip and these things, trying to get us into this cage. But I feel totally sure that we're going to be just fine, that this world is going to turn into this paradise it's supposed to be very shortly. Because if this group, this elite group, stops messing around, I think this world is going to turn into an absolutely beautiful place. Because people say the world is crazy, there's so much violence there. But when you track these things down, it goes back to the same group again and again and again. And I know that for my own experience, somebody in Tehran is just as nice as somebody on the Bahamas or in Sweden. They peace-loving people who just wants to be happy with their friends and family and be useful in the world and do their best. They're not violent, hateful people. These things come when people are in desperate situations or being depraved, which they've also been by this group as well. So I feel very extremely optimistic.
Oh, that's wonderful. We have recently, of course, had Sandy Hook, and there have been other, I guess, smaller events, even more recent than that. But certainly the Sandy Hook situation for us has been something like 9/11, in the sense that I think at least it has captured and perplexed the people of the United States, possibly as well as the rest of the world, in terms of what has been put out there in the press, to the public, in the alternative media. Even the alternative media are being completely confused by so-called actors who are playing parts, et cetera, et cetera. And at the very beginning of this interview, I talked to you about this description that you had in your book at a certain point about this. I don't know if it's a drama or if it's just a story, but in which they describe how a plot was planned in which even the person being killed was in on it, thinking they were going to pretend to kill them, and then they actually do kill them. And the suggestion you were making, it seemed to me, that was something, was a part of what happened to Palme. And I'm just wondering if you still believe that, and if you could describe it for people listening, what I'm talking about.
I totally believe that these things are set up. It's like I haven't even looked into the Sandy Hook, because it's just one, again, the same pattern. Every time there's a school shooting or something, it's the same again and again and again. And what they're trying to do, they always use this so-called three-step rocket. They secretly create a problem, like a school shooting or 9/11 or a bomb going off in the subways or whatever. Before that, they prepared a patsy that they can blame. And so they create a problem to get a reaction from us so that they can come with a solution. So at the moment, they're trying to get guns away from normal people so that they can take over more easily. So they have all these violent shootings saying, oh, we must get rid of guns. I'm not pro-gun or anti-gun, whatever. I'm just saying this is what they're trying to do. And so they stage these awful things. And but with this Sandy Hook, it feels that it didn't even happen as far as I've been able to see. It's like with actors and all of strange, loads of strange things going on. But, well, what can I say? I just feel it's falling apart. It's falling apart from them. They're getting sloppy and desperate. And so that's why it's easier and easier to see what's going on, you know.
No doubt about that. I think they are showing their hand more and more. I think they are quite desperate. But what about this idea of this story that you described? Can you tell the people what I'm referring to?
I can. It's actually a politician that worked quite closely to Olof Palme that wrote this book just a few years after. And what he said was that Olof Palme, or the politicians, there are no names, and this book was labeled a children's book, then, so nobody really noticed it. It was sort of put away. What he said was that Olof Palme was part of the elite, that he was this elite are very often involved in very strange sexual things with minors or homosexual acts or very strange rituals and these things. And that during one of these parties, he got infected with a virus, I believe the HIV virus, and that it came to a point where from everything going great, he suddenly, when he got this infection, that since this was in 86, you know, just this was when AIDS started to freak the whole world out, and Rock Hudson became the face of the disease for the whole world. It's also a disease that it's very on its own, so you can't hide it. And so what this book suggests is that his advisor, Colleen Boom, after freaking out, they said, listen, we need to sort this out. So how can we do it? And they decided that to go the Kennedy way, to turn him into a martyr, instead of him becoming a symbol for this evil disease, they said, if we can stage a killing, we can, and we have the whole backup with public relations and all of this, we can turn you into a saint overnight. So after a while, he agreed to do that. This was about 6 months before he died. And this is exactly when he starts acting very strange, going against his normal ways and acting against the elite and stopping weapon transports and stuff like that to clean up his case so that after he was so-called dead, that they wouldn't be able to track down awful things about him that would destroy this image of him being this worldly saint. So what they decided to do was to stage a killing, but he would not actually be shot. It would just be a fake shooting. But they needed to bring in real professionals to do it because nobody could know about this, only a very, very few. And what they did was they used this Östling, called Gustav Östling, as the spider in the net, so that he was the one who met up with all of these, with the whole hit team, and he was the one who supplied them with weapons. And that, but what he was supposed to do was to when the actual hit was about to take place, exchange the bullet for what do you call it, fake bullets, not sharp ammo.
Blanks,
yeah. So what if you see what happened that night, it follows this exact system. It makes perfect sense because there were two ambulances. One ambulance was driven by one of these policemen as well that jumped in. That was not the one that came first because another one came first and sort of interrupted the whole thing. But Palmer was shot. He was supposed to be picked up in one of the ambulances. He was picked up in another one. he was driven to the hospital, and in the hospital, the people receiving him, one of them was his relative, and people didn't recognize him. It was almost like there was a double, because the nurses at the hospital said, "What the? He didn't look the way he said he was bigger and so on." And afterwards, the autopsy protocol, the death certificate, all of these has been faked. There's massive mistakes in them. The addresses that doesn't exist, and the autopsy protocol have been totally wiped out, you know, with black ink to cover up something. There's a massive thing that is wrong in the whole thing. But it turned, in my opinion, there was two operations going on at the same time. Like I said before, there was this operation, if we call it the fake killing, let's call it plan A. But at the same time, there was a plan B of people from the military industrial complex, NATO. And so they had meetings in Wiltshire in England, where they decided to get rid of him because he was just totally, they couldn't trust him anymore. But they found out that there was another operation going on. What they did was that they put in their own team, but sort of like shadowing the first team. And they had a second shooter on a rooftop on the other side of the street. It's getting really complicated here, but this is what I believe happened. So when the shooter down in the street level came up and was supposed to shoot him from the back with a blank, at the exact same time, he was shot from a rooftop on the other side of Sveavägen. This is why they have stopped the autopsy protocol. It's why there's so many strange things going on, because suddenly, instead of a fake killing, they ended up with a dead body. Also implying that all of these police and people in the investigation were directly involved in the killing itself instead of a fake killing.
Yes, it's...
But it goes even deeper than that. It's sort of, it just goes on and on. I tell you, it's almost like...
Well, there's a question as well about the wife, that you said she was shot, but there seems to be a big question as to whether she was shot or she wasn't shot.
She wasn't shot.
The coat, she had two coats and...
Yeah.
The
whole way that the Palmer family has acted is very suspicious, extremely suspicious. The wife, like you said, the shot that was fired at her, it said that the bullet went in through her fur coat and then out. It passed just where her shoulders on her back shoulder blades are. And it said that that the bullet just touched her. No one has ever been allowed to look at that wound or anything like that. And even if a bullet goes, if you imagine a bullet going that close to your back, a bullet from a 357 Magnum, it's so powerful that the impact, even though if the bullet doesn't touch you, if it just passes like a centimeter from your skin, it will still make a big impact because of the air pressure that involved. Nothing like that. And also like, the coat that she had on, there's a photo when she runs into the hospital where she was, when they left the crime scene, she was in the ambulance, but the photo is taken when she runs out of a police car. You know, where did she swap over there? And the coat that she has on there and the coat that witnesses have seen is not the same coat that has been put forward as evidence with the bullet holes in. You see, we have a problem here.
it's amazing that, you know, the discrepancies. A lot like for us, the Sandy Hook thing, where nothing matches up
nothing,
or makes sense.
Nothing.
So we're very almost at the end of the show here, and I do have a couple questions in the chat. Let me see if I can grab them very quickly. Let's see. One person is asking, I guess they want to know if you have an email. Do you have a way that people can contact you on your website?
Yeah, of course. On the website, murderofpalme.com. It goes to my website that is also called oledamagod.com, and there are contact details and You can download the book from there in two languages. You can download for free my other books as well, and my music. Everything is for free on donation basis. And
wonderful.
And I guess there's a guest book there. I love to hear from people.
Okay. So. And then someone wants to know, have you considered the people running the world could be reptiles?
I met David Icke on a few occasions, and I've heard about these things, and I need to stay on a street level. You know, it's like I highly respect David Icke and people who put this forward. I have absolutely no idea. I just know that if I started talking about reptiles, I'd lose credibility with these other stuff. So I've just totally have not gone into that area.
Okay, fair enough. And someone else wants to know, someone wants to know, do you know Stieg Larsson?
Stieg Larsson was, he was involved, he was looking into this baseball gang, this right extremist concentration of policemen in Norrmalm's police station, the one that we are talking about. And he was, there was quite a few people very worried. The former commander of this group, or he was the superior working for them, he was trying to stop this group, and he ended up committing suicide by stabbing himself 15 times and then hitting himself in the face with a bat. It's a okay. Suicide. To this day, it's a suicide. His family still thinks that he committed suicide. But
who?
I tell you,
are you saying that Stieg Larsson supposedly did this?
No. I'm saying that Stieg Larsson was interested in the same group, and he was writing about this group, and then he died.